This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If we want consumers to do the right thing, the do the right thing starts at the grocery store, not at the curbside bin.
Many of us concerned with the environment are conscientious about sorting our garbage. Those of us lucky enough to live in cities with curbside recycling feel pretty good that the majority of our garbage is diverted from landfill. Well, before we get too smug about it, perhaps we should take a closer look at where that waste goes after it leaves our hands. For example, did you know that pretty much all paper milk cartons in this country are plastic lined and therefore end up in landfills? Or that 15% of the paper we ship to China for recycling doesn't actually get recycled? This week on Sea Change Radio, Mark Murray, the executive director of Californians Against Waste, reveals the garbage in our global garbage systems. We discuss what consumers, manufacturers, and retailers can do to improve the current system, where gains are being made, and what areas are ripe for improvement. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mark Murray. He is the executive director of Californians Against Waste. Mark, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be back.
In 2013, California boasted a recycling rate of 85%. And when we spoke a couple years ago in 2017, that number was down to 79%. Where do you think things are right now?
Yeah, so admittedly, we've actually dropped further. So the beverage container recycling rate in California is now down to 75%. And that's the lowest the rate has been in a decade. We continue to have closed recycling centers for glass and plastic beverage containers. And so work has to be done to rebuild that infrastructure, to upgrade and update the incentives to support the collection and processing infrastructure in California. There was some legislation included in this year's budget that will provide $5 million for low-volume recycling centers, and we're working on a package of legislation that's aimed at supporting the markets for recycled materials so that we can hopefully increase the scrap value and increase the profit in recycling, which will hopefully stimulate rates.
And how much of those rates are being affected by a changing policy in China in terms of what the Chinese will take from the U.S. waste management companies?
Yeah, so I think that folks by this point are aware that something's happening with China and recycling. And so basically, China had been the outlet, the market outlet, for most of our paper and most of our plastic that we were collecting for recycling in our curbside recycling programs. And basically, China enabled us and got us in the bad habit of instead of sorting our recyclables into the categories that could be used by manufacturers, China, in order to entice us to send more and more material to them, said, just send it to us mixed up and we'll sort it out. And so for the last decade, China has been using, really exploiting cheap labor and a poor regulatory infrastructure for what happens to residuals. And as a result, China was actually sorting through our mixed paper and mixed plastics, taking the good stuff and recycling that and throwing the rest away. And in China, throwing the rest away sometimes meant burning it, sometimes meant illegally dumping it into a river.
I imagine since it's not that well regulated that we really have no data on what percentage is getting recycled versus getting thrown away there either, right?
Yeah, we don't have any real data. So China, the Chinese government basically said these operators that are exploiting labor, that are polluting the environment with the dumping the residual, the non-recyclables in the environment, that has to stop. So China really was looking internally and saying, we're not going to allow these fly-by-night brokers to continue to accept this junk from the United States and from other developing countries. So when we got stuck with this, we had to start dealing with this material ourselves. We found, so this material basically had to stay here, and we needed to basically clean it up. We had to sort it. And when we've done that, we found that of the bales of mixed paper that we were sending to China, only about 85 to 90% of it was actually recyclable paper. There was lots of plastic-coated paper that's not recyclable. There were, you know, milk cartons and juice boxes. There were lots of plastic bags and plastic tape that was mixed in. So about 15% of the paper that we were sending to China in our recycling bins was not recyclable. In the case of plastics, we were sending them, you know, what we call the 3 through 7 plastics, the plastics that have the number 3 through the number 7 on the bottom of the package. And it ends up that hardly any of that material was ever being recycled. What China was doing was sorting through these bales of mixed plastic to find the inadvertent aluminum can or PET bottle or HDPE bottle, those are the ones and twos, that were inadvertently in those bales. And in some cases, that material, that recyclable material in those mixed plastic bales, only represented 25% of the material. So the bottom line is that curbside programs in the United States, including in California, have been assuming that because China was buying mixed plastics from us, that they must have had some kind of recycling market. And the bottom line is that they never had a recycling market for the 3 through 7s. They never had a recycling market for the plastic-coated paper cartons, the plastic-coated juice boxes. They never had a market for the, you know, the beverage pouches. So those materials were never recycled. They were never recyclable.
It's pretty remarkable that there was no real vigilance in terms of supply chain management of this.
Yeah, it's, you know, we failed to take responsibility for the end-of-life management of this material. We effectively exported the responsibility overseas. And I have to say that, you know, just because China has closed their doors, that hasn't stopped, you know, many local governments, many collection programs in the United States from still trying desperately to export their material overseas just so they can continue to call it recycling. And so we've seen with China's closing its doors, material has gone to Vietnam, to Indonesia, to the Philippines, and we're seeing the same kind of stories.
So would it be fair to assume that there's a correlation in terms of dropping rates in California? And then I guess a subset of that question would be, can we then assume that maybe it's not so bad that the rate has dropped if more things are being recycled, if our efficiency rate, so to speak, has gone up?
So let me take a crack at that. So I think that, you know, ultimately, and this may be an unpopular thing to say, but ultimately I think the decision by China to say no to our mixed plastic and our mixed paper is ultimately going to be a good thing, because it is going to force us to confront what is really recyclable and what is not recyclable. And it is a, I guess the reality is that even though we were diverting these bales of mixed paper and these bales of mixed plastic overseas and calling it recycling, much of that material was never being recycled. You know, as I said, 3/4 of those mixed plastics were never being recycled. Maybe 15% of the paper bales were never being recycled because of contamination, because of non-recyclable material. And so I'm not sure that we've actually seen, I don't know that the planet has actually seen a reduction in the amount of real recycling that was happening. We're just having a more honest view of what was always happening. And that is that clean paper that's plastic-free, that's contaminant-free, has always been recyclable and remains recyclable. Number one, plastic bottles for soft drinks and water bottles. Those remain 100% recyclable. High-density polyethylene, which is like a milk jug or a detergent bottle, they remain recyclable. But a lot of this other crap, the so-called 3-7 plastics, polystyrene, polyvinyl chloride.
Maybe give some examples of the end products of these, of polystyrene and things. So when what is somebody buying that may not, that may have the recycling symbol on it, but is probably not that valuable to a recycler?
Yeah, I think that, you know, at the top of that list would be anything that is made of polystyrene, whether it's a flat thermoform polystyrene, like a solo cup, or a foamed polystyrene burger box, or the polystyrene that it, your stereo or TV is packed in.
Those peanuts.
Yeah, the peanuts, whether it's the peanuts or the big blocks, the polystyrene is not recyclable. We're even finding that the polyethylene bags and film, not recyclable. There is some opportunity if you're willing to take that polyethylene back to your grocery store. If they accept, if they have a bin there, they may be able to recycle it there because it's clean.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mark Murray. He's the executive director of Californians Against Waste. So, Mark, we've gone through some of the hindrances to recycling and some of the products that may have that recycling logo on them but aren't actually that valuable to recyclers. What are some of the more valuable recyclables? What are some of the plastics and paper products, the normal part of our waste flow that a waste management company kind of relishes receiving?
Yeah. Well. So let's take a half step back and, you know, let's think about what is recycling. Recycling is not what I do at the curb. Recycling is not what happens in the recycling truck or even at the material recovery facility. Recycling happens when a manufacturer wants to purchase that secondary material, whether that secondary material is paper or metal or glass or plastic. And so the only time that recycling works is when there's a buyer. And that buyer adds value, which then finances the collection system. And so the irony is that we are seeing tremendous value in paper, clean paper, metals. Those materials continue to have value, continue to be needed by manufacturers to make new stuff. We also continue to see value in certain kinds of plastic. So number one, PET, which is your soft drink bottles and your bottled water. The manufacturers of those bottles, the folks that are selling bottles to Coke and Pepsi and Nestle Waters, they are using increasing amounts of recycled content in those bottles. Nestle Waters, largest bottled water maker in the country, is using 50% or more recycled content. I just saw that Coca-Cola in Japan is saying that they're going to use 100% recycled content in their plastic beverage containers. So there is a value for some types of plastic and a closed-loop recycling opportunity for those types of plastic, just like we have with aluminum cans, just like we have with glass bottles. At the same time, there's lots of plastic that has zero end-use market. that has no value to any manufacturer. And we can dutifully set it aside in our curbside recycling bin as much as we want, but if nobody is willing to buy it, if there is no manufacturer that has found a way to use that material, then it's not really being recycled. It's not really recycling. So I guess the point there is that recycling is not what we do at curbside. Recycling is what manufacturers do. And therefore, our policy approach to recycling needs to change. Rather than thinking that the beginning and end of recycling is better consumer education and, you know, more pressure on the public to do the right thing, really the focus has to be on manufacturers. If you're bringing a material into the stream of commerce, if you're using a material, you better have a way to buy that material back. We've got to have closed loop recycling, or this material is just going to accumulate and become pollution.
What does that mean, closed loop recycling?
So closed loop recycling basically refers to the producer of a material buying it back, eating it. So it's Coca-Cola buying back their plastic bottles.
And traditionally, we've seen it with like milk jugs, right?
Right. And I guess, you know, that's not only is it it's a great example because you're not having to mine and process new raw material to make a new package every single time, but it really is a metaphor for what needs to happen across the material stream. Paper recycling works because the paper industry has found that it's more valuable to make paper products out of secondary fiber than to cut down new trees. The aluminum industry has determined that it's cheaper for them. It uses less energy. It's a lower carbon footprint when I make, whether it's an aluminum can or it's a Boeing 737 airplane, when I make that out of recycled aluminum, it is cheaper, uses less energy, it's better for the environment than if I am mining bauxite. Same goes for glass. If I'm a wine bottle maker and I can use old glass bottles to make new glass bottles, I'm using less energy, I run my furnaces at a lower temperature, and I'm generating less pollution, less CO2. So across the board, when we use secondary materials to make stuff, we can reduce the cost and we can reduce the carbon footprint. And so the idea is to incorporate that responsibility into the products that we're selling. So basically saying to the packaging sector, saying to the brand owners, if you want to introduce this product into the marketplace, you have to take responsibility for its end of life. Now, maybe that means putting it, you know, closed loop back into the product itself. Maybe it means finding some other recycling end use for that material. But the bottom line is, it can't be the public's responsibility. It can't be local government's responsibility. It can't be our curbside recycling service provider's responsibility. It has to be a manufacturer responsibility.
So let's dive into the different segments here and then the different pieces of the recycling puzzle and their responsibility in improving, in achieving higher recycling rates. So producer responsibility, consumer responsibility, and then waste management responsibility efforts. Let's start with consumers, since this is something listeners are thinking to themselves, I probably should have put that into the recycling bin, or maybe I shouldn't. Is there a downside to a consumer putting something that may be not the best product for recycling, something that's kind of in the gray area, let's say one of those Tetra Paks that carries broth, like chicken broth and things like that. Sometimes they don't have the recycling logo on them because they must have some kind of funky lining inside. Would it be better to throw that into the blue recycling bin in California, or do you have a responsibility to not do that and put it into the black waste bin?
That's a great question. We need honest information from our service providers, from our local governments, about what is really recyclable and what is not recyclable. And we've gotten in this bad habit of the curbside programs trying to keep it too simple. They think that we're too stupid to understand the distinction. And so they kind of err on the side of saying, if you're not certain, just throw it in the bin. And the bottom line is that when we put a non-recyclable plastic, like a PET thermoform, for example, like the clamshell that you get your strawberries in, or if you go to Trader Joe's and they put all of the apples and tomatoes into these plastic briefcases, that material right now is not recyclable. And the problem when we kind of suggest to people, just go ahead and throw that in the recycling bin, is twofold. Number one, it's increasing the cost of the recycling program. It's contaminating the other recyclables. It has to be sorted out and thrown away. So that's a problem. But the bigger problem is we're continuing to buy this crap. When we perceive that we may be able to recycle it, we're less likely to source reduce. We're less likely to avoid the packaging because we think, at least I can throw it in the recycling bin. So if we want consumers to do the right thing, the do the right thing starts at the grocery store, not at the curbside bin. It starts with rejecting packaging that is not recyclable. So, for example, your Tetra Pak, whether it's a juice box or a soup. Now, that product is technically recyclable. I think there are maybe three locations on the East Coast of the United States where that material can be recycled. Nobody in the West Coast is availing themselves of that opportunity. So that means that material is basically not being recycled. If it goes and gets mixed up with the paper, it's basically going to be a contaminant, whether it's thrown away at a landfill in California or it's thrown away in China or Indonesia or Vietnam, it's going to be disposed. And so the answer is, I shouldn't be buying this product in the first place. And we can't make those decisions as consumers unless our local governments and our recycling service providers are honest with us.
And that brings me to my next question. The goal of local governments is to increase more and more of our waste stream into the recycling tranche. I know San Francisco has gone, I think, from 75 to 80% of their waste stream, and they kind of gloat that that's way ahead of similar sized cities like Houston, where I think a few years ago it was in the 10 to 20%. But is that a 75 to 80% recyclable, reusable, compostable waste stream accurate when so much of that quote unquote recycling material is not actually getting recycled?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, San Francisco does a fabulous job of providing an array of recycling options to both their residents as well as, commercial enterprises. I was in San Francisco this past weekend, and everywhere you go in public, there is effectively a three-bin system where there is recyclables, compostables, and then regular trash. The challenge is that there is no magic that San Francisco has figured out on how to recycle polystyrene. They haven't figured out any magic in terms of plastic bag recycling. They haven't figured out any magic in terms of what we call the 3 through 7 plastics, the PET thermoform recycling. So the bottom line is San Francisco is successfully diverting about 80% of the material. So they're diverting it from the landfill that San Francisco would use out in Altamont.
So just San Francisco's landfill. It may end, a lot of this stuff may end up in a landfill somewhere in the earth.
That's right. And I think that San Francisco and their service provider, Recology, is working really hard to put pressure on manufacturers to create end-use markets for this material. They're taking their responsibility beyond the curbside bin, and they're becoming advocates for market development. But the bottom line is that there is no difference between San Francisco and Los Angeles and Houston in terms of the actual ability to recycle polystyrene, the actual ability to recycle a plastic-coated milk carton. Nobody can recycle that material because the only way it gets recycled is if there's a manufacturer that's willing to buy it. And there is no manufacturer that's willing to buy that material, not from San Francisco, not from Houston, not from Los Angeles.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mark Murray. He's the executive director of Californians Against Waste. So, Mark, what kind of financial incentives do you see being effective to change the production habits of these these manufacturers.
The producers have to be responsible for the material that they put into the stream of commerce. And the approaches that we can take are either to basically mandate that they buy it back, that we mandate that they achieve real recycling rates, or we mandate that they pay the cost. So those are the tools that are available. It's to basically make recycling and the buying the material, actually achieving a meaningful recycling rate, real recycling, a condition of sale. For example, you know, we banned plastic bags and a variety of other non-recyclable products in California because those materials were not recyclable. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to have to ban every single product that is not recyclable, but we should set that standard, and we should give manufacturers an opportunity to demonstrate its recyclability. If they can demonstrate the recyclability of polystyrene, demonstrate the recyclability of plastic milk cartons, then they should be able to continue to sell that product. But if they can't demonstrate the recyclability, then that material has to be phased out of the marketplace. We have many options for delivering food and beverages to consumers, and most of those options are actually recyclable or reusable. So the tools are there. Nobody's going to starve. Nobody's going to miss out on their, you know, their coffee or their breakfast or their burger because of restrictions on packaging. But we need to focus on packaging that can meet meaningful, real recycling standards, and that responsibility has to be put on the manufacturers. So an example is in California right now, Assembly Member Ting from San Francisco is carrying legislation, AB 792, that will compel the beverage industry to use 25%, increasing to 50%, and ultimately 75% recycled material in their plastic beverage containers. Now, the only way they can use 75% recycled material in plastic beverage containers is if they support, financially and with public education, a system that gets 75% of those packages back. This legislation is putting that responsibility on the manufacturers, saying, this is a condition of sale. You're going to have to buy this material back from the marketplace, and in doing so, you're going to support the recycling infrastructure.
So what can people do to help your fight, the fight that Californians Against Waste is waging?
Well, I think that California has an opportunity to be a model for the country. And by adapting these producer responsibilities in California this summer, I think we have a chance to send a signal to manufacturers really across the country and across the globe. And folks can go to cawrecycles.org or write your legislator and urge them to support plastic pollution and recycling legislation.
He's the executive director of Californians Against Waste, Mark Murray. Mark, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having us, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Grant Green and the Allman Brothers Band.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.